It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. There's been a flurry of news and political ads related to the presidential race, but of course that's not the only game in town this year, even if it feels like other campaigns are being overshadowed. Our news department here at Wisconsin Public Radio has a new resource for voters. The news team compiled a survey of candidates around the state. You can see each candidate's answers and positions at wpr.org/election2024. The outcomes of these races could determine the future of issues like reproductive rights, how much you pay in taxes, marijuana legalization, availability of affordable housing, gun rights, and more. And with new legislative maps, the race for the state legislature, especially the assembly, may be more competitive this time around. Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Bridget Bowden is Special Projects Reporter at WPR. Bridget, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bridget, a lot of issues, of course, at stake in this year's election. In this candidate guide, where did the questions come from? How did you narrow it down?
So we have actually been collecting responses over the past few months from people all over the state on our website to questions like, what questions do you have for the candidates? What could elected officials do to make your community a better place? And we looked at those answers and we saw what people care about. And this was hundreds of answers over the past several months. And that is what we asked the candidates about. And we asked, about all sorts of different topics, everything from climate change to abortion law, even some more national issues for some of the federal races. And all of those questions came directly from, the people of Wisconsin who told us what they care about.
And that's a little different. A lot of times in the media, we come up with a list of questions. Why was it important to reach out to the people of Wisconsin to generate this list of questions for candidates?
Yeah, so this is a part of our America Amplified election engagement effort this year. America Amplified is a partnership between dozens of public radio stations across the country, and it's really an effort to engage with voters and find out, what is important to folks this election season and, make sure that we in the media are not the ones driving the narrative.
And Sean, as you look at the things that came from listeners and then the questions that ended up going to these candidates, I mean, a lot of them, I think, are expected. Were there ones that stood out to you as maybe ones that we didn't think would be at the top of people's minds or we don't expect as the big political issues here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, one that was kind of at the top of the list in terms of what people volunteered was the environment and followed by healthcare. So these are definitely issues that we know about on a national and statewide level. I mean, they're part of the debate, obviously. But when you hear polling on what the top issues are of the day, that's not often at the top of the list. So, I mean, you got to think about kind of the way that we did things through this project versus the way somebody like Marquette University Law School poll does stuff when it comes to issues. This survey for us was a chance for people to just tell us, hey, what's on top of your mind? What's the big issue for you? And so environment, healthcare, education, economy kind of came up in that order. When somebody like Marquette polls people on the issues, they decide the issues ahead of time. They've got like eight and they ask people, how do you rank these? And so in that setting, the economy, immigration, and abortion policy are the top three.
Bridget, that's how we got the questions. What has the response rate been looking like when it comes to answers? Of course, not every candidate will respond to every questionnaire that comes their way, but I saw quite a bit of response when I went through the website.
Yeah, I want to make sure to mention that this guide is for all federal and state races. So that's, the race for president, U.S. House, U.S. Senate, and both houses of our state legislature. So that's hundreds of races, hundreds of candidates. And we had more than half of them return our survey. So I think that's pretty good.
I want to focus in on the race for the legislature, a topic very familiar to the two of you from the Mapped Out podcast. Our legislative maps have changed again in Wisconsin. And Sean, things are a little different this time around. Bring us up to date on the maps we're actually voting on in November.
Things are incredibly different this time around in the race for the state assembly, where, for the last 14 years or so, there basically hasn't been a race for the state assembly. Ever since Republicans took over control of state government in 2010, They drew maps in 2011 that cemented their advantage, got even more Republican in the 2021 round of redistricting. And what you have now is in 2023, liberals took over the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They overturned those maps, put it back to the legislature and Governor Tony Evers to draw a map of their own if they wanted to. A lot of people didn't think that would happen, but it did. The legislature ended up passing a map that was drawn by Governor Tony Evers, and that map in the state assembly is very competitive. If you just break it down in terms of which seats lean Republican and which seats lean Democrat, it is ever so slightly Republican, but either party could win this race. Just to kind of put it in perspective, if Governor Tony Evers had been the candidate in all these assembly districts in 2022, Democrats would have had a majority in this map. But Republican Ron Johnson also won a majority in this map. That's how close it is. And that's why you're going to see a lot of attention paid to these campaigns for the legislature this year.
Bridget, any talk about getting the band back together and doing another mapped out episode, maybe after this election?
You know, we'll have to see what happens with the maps and with the election.
We are talking about the November election here in Wisconsin and a new WPR candidate guide based on questions that the people of Wisconsin put forward. We have special projects reporter Bridget Bowden with us and State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Bridget, we were just talking about the importance of these state legislative elections for Wisconsin with these new maps. What kind of questions were you asking candidates for the state legislature, again, generated by our audience, by the people of Wisconsin?
Right. So we did ask candidates for all the different races, questions that were, specific to their office. So we wouldn't have asked candidates for the assembly a question about the Middle East, for example. So for our state house candidates, we asked them about what they would do about the environment, what sorts of abortion policy they support. We asked them about, let's see, the cost of living, all sorts of issues that are really at the top of minds of people across Wisconsin.
And Bridget, how much depth did candidates, especially at that state level, go into in their answers?
So we did have a character limit. So, there was only a certain amount of space. It was a generous character limit, I should say, though. I would say that it depends on the candidate. Some of them went very in depth on every single question, gave us long answers, and some of the answers were a bit shorter. But we did write the questions in a way that sort of required candidates to get kind of specific. So I hope that these answers, are helpful to folks as they maybe are trying to decide who to vote for.
Oh, hey, Bridget, I should say, if there's a candidate out there listening or their staff are saying, oh no, we never responded. Are you still taking responses to these
Yes.
questionnaires?
Yes, we absolutely are. We would love, I mean, we've had more than half of candidates respond, and we'd love to get that number up even more. So we will still be taking responses now through the election.
Now, Sean, we talked about how the legislative maps are going to change things this time around in Wisconsin elections. You recently wrote a piece about state campaign finance laws, big change under Republican control in 2015. What was the origin of that? How has it played out this year?
Yeah, this was also something that Republicans did when they controlled everything. So they had big majorities in the legislature, and Scott Walker was the Republican governor. So they got to decide basically how the world of campaign finance was going to look in Wisconsin. There had been a lot of recent federal court decisions that suggested, some pretty bluntly, that Wisconsin's laws were too complicated, unconstitutional. And so Republicans said, we're going to start fresh. They drew up laws that included one that gave political parties an immense amount of power in Wisconsin to raise unlimited funds, and also legislative campaign committees to raise unlimited amounts of funds and to transfer unlimited amounts of funds. So what that means in practice is, if you are giving to a candidate for the state assembly, if you're a donor, you can max out at $1,000. You can't give any more than that. Those are the limits. But if you have millions of dollars to spend and you want to get involved in the political process in Wisconsin, you can give millions of bucks to the state party or one of the state parties or one of the legislative campaign committees, and then they can transfer that money to the candidates. And so you see just massive amounts of money flowing through these committees to these candidates. And I think to a lot of people's surprise, it's been Democrats who have by and large won the fundraising race in the last couple of elections.
Do we know, I know the reports come in even after Election Day. Do we have a sense of how that fundraising is playing out so far in 2024?
So far in 2024, it's been a big Democratic Party of Wisconsin advantage. I will say, though, that because there's lots of ways that money can find its way into the political system, I don't think you can look at that and say, you know, that they are winning the race, period. I think they're winning the race, this element of the race. For example, there's new numbers out today that show that Republican donors, big Republican donors, actually gave more money to the legislative campaign committees that go to Republicans. So there's lots of ways for money to get into these races this time around. I think just Democrats have been a bigger force than the party expected back when these laws were rewritten back in 2015.
And Bridget, we mentioned that candidates can still respond to the questionnaires. You mentioned that America Amplified project where we're asking people to weigh in on what they want to hear from candidates. The questionnaire is already done, but people could still weigh in, right? They could still participate, and it might shape our news coverage or our coverage here on Wisconsin Today. How can people still give that kind of feedback to us?
Yep. So you can find the web form where you can weigh in at WPR.org/election2024. Another cool thing about that form is if you have a question about how to vote in Wisconsin, or, you know, a question about how to register or any of those mechanics, you can submit that question right there and we will answer it for you.
Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Sean, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Been talking to Bridget Bowden, special projects reporter at WPR, and Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. They were with us today to share WPR's new candidate guide for the November election and what's at stake when voters go to the polls this fall. You can find that candidate guide online at WPR.org/election2024. That's WPR.org/election2024. Coming up, two Wisconsin researchers share the potential impact of wind and solar energy production on reservations around the country.
The 25% that are the poorest are also the 25% with the most wind and solar economic potential.
That's next here on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. During fall migration season, birds traveling south through Wisconsin encounter hazards like windmills, cats, and windows. Volunteers at the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance count birds that have died in collisions with windows to raise awareness and to encourage lawmakers to endorse bird-safe glass. Anna Marie Yanni shadowed a volunteer last month.
Ann Mater wakes up before the sun. She laces on hiking boots so she can hike unstable ground. And then she drives over to the American Family Insurance headquarters in Madison. She calls in to let them know she's arrived.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling from the Bird Collision Corp.
Mater is part of a team of volunteers at Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance who survey dead birds. They track the number and type of birds that have died at over a dozen sites in and around Madison. Today is the first day of a survey Mater will do for 6 weeks. At one turn, she passes three employees walking to the cafeteria. Mater spots a dead bird by their feet.
Oh, they just walked right by that one.
She takes pictures of the dead bird and the windows above it. She thinks she sees a smudge where it hit. Then she pulls out gloves and a plastic bag and gently picks up the bird.
Swainson's thrush, I think. I've had many of them.
This is Mater's ninth season surveying birds that have died here.
Yeah, I unfortunately see birds close up this way more than I do when they're alive.
Mater has been a self-proclaimed bird nerd since she was a kid. She and her husband went bird watching for their first date. Later, they had bluebird boxes in their backyard. And in 2020, when Mater retired, she signed up for the Collision Corps. organizations around the nation have similar teams that track bird collisions. It's a big problem. By some estimates, building collisions are the second biggest killer of birds, behind cats.
Birds came before windows, so they haven't been able to evolve to deal with windows. They don't understand glass, so they crash into them a lot, and that's a big hazard for them.
That's Carolyn Byers. She's the Director of Education at Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance. She says migrating birds are particularly vulnerable. Many migrate at night using the stars, and they can be pulled into cities by bright lights.
They can become disoriented and they'll fly towards the bright lights rather than continuing on their path.
Hazards like these lights and windows are taking a toll. A study that analyzed data from nearly five decades found that North American bird populations have shrunk across the board by about 30% since 1970. Avian ecologist Anna Pidgeon has seen this over time. She's been studying birds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for decades.
I certainly have noticed fewer birds in the air.
She says over a third of America's migratory bird species are at risk. Climate change is impacting them too, with extreme weather events happening more often. But Pidgeon says there are things Wisconsinites can do to help the migrating birds, such as bringing cats inside,
turning off unnecessary lights in all kinds of buildings, planting developments or in individual yards, planting native species.
Back at American Family Insurance, Mater has seen three dead migratory birds. She approaches a spot on site that she used to dread surveying, Skybridge 6. From 2020 to 2023, she found so many dead birds here.
This is where I used to cringe, coming around.
Because of the data Mater collected, in 2023, American Family Insurance put little dot stickers on the Skybridge's windows to deter the birds. Mater's team has only found one bird since. She put the same stickers up on her windows at home.
I refuse to have a bird hit at home if I'm doing this here.
A 2020 city ordinance says all new large buildings in Madison need to have bird-safe windows. A landscape architect at American Family Insurance says they are discussing replacing aging windows with ones that are better for birds. Anna Marie Yanni, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. A new study in the journal Nature looks at the economic potential of solar and wind energy on Native American reservations. When those reservations were established, most of them in the mid-19th century, they were intentionally placed to avoid known reserves of coal, oil, and other lucrative natural resources. But now researchers find those same reservations could benefit greatly by harvesting renewable energies like wind and solar power should tribal members choose to do so. We have the study authors from UW-Madison with us. Sarah Johnston is an assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, and Dominic Parker is the Bascom Professor of Applied Economics. They talked with my co-host Kate Archer-Kent about their findings.
Nick, I want to start with you. Indigenous lands have a lot of potential for solar and wind power. Can you frame this for us? How big is that potential?
Their estimates of potential in the upper and lower bound, but somewhere between, say, 7 billion and 19 billion, if renewable energy potential on reservations tracks what's expected to happen off reservations.
Sarah, you know, when you look at that type of analysis and that type of possibility, how much more wind and solar do reservations have than perhaps non-tribal lands?
Yeah, so and we do find that reservation areas are disproportionately endowed with this resources, so they have more than private lands do. And a lot of that is because they were located, intentionally they were located in areas that were bad for farming, but those are often windy and sunny areas that have a lot of potential.
And Nick, there's this historical reason, which is that Indigenous people were pushed off good farmland, forced to move to bad farmland. Can you talk about that history of forced migration and how it relates to reservations having the potential for this renewable energy today?
Particularly in the 19th century, when a lot of Indian reservations were created, there was pressure from settlers, there was pressure from the federal government to place tribes in areas that weren't desirable for settlers from Europe moving westward from the east part of the country. And so what resources were desired then were those with known values, say gold and silver, precious metals, good farmland that was close to water, that had sufficient rainfall. And so the land that was set aside for reservations typically didn't have these resources. And so what you have today is reservations that were almost incidentally or as an accident of history, well endowed with wind and solar. And, now the issue is, can the tribes that want to convert that into a financial gain, can they do that? Or are there some barriers that stand in their way?
And we're going to look at those potential barriers in a moment. But you make this point in the study that this study of economic potential is not meant to advance green colonialism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So historically, tribes have been in a pinch in terms of their resource endowments. On one hand, well-endowed resources on Indian reservations have attracted unwanted attention from the federal government or from settlers over time. And the federal government had set colonial policies to enable access to those resources. And so the point about green colonialism is now we find ourselves in a position where there's a lot of momentum and push towards the energy transition. And so the point in the paper that we were trying to make with that comment is, you know, energy sovereignty for tribes means they shouldn't be pushed into developing green energy because it's a way of addressing climate change. On the other hand, governments shouldn't stand in the way of tribes who do want to develop in this form.
And understanding that there are prospectors out there on green energy projects because they do see the value in that and the potential.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As they have throughout history, have seen potential value of natural resources on indigenous land. We're not just talking about the United States. I mean, globally, there's prospectors who sometimes have really good intentions. They think of this as a win-win. If we could develop indigenous lands, then indigenous people could gain financially, and this could be a win-win. And so so a lot of times the intentions are good, but this can lead to enormous pressure on tribes to do things that they may not want to do as a community.
Sarah, when you ran the numbers on the economic potential of harvesting renewable energy for tribes, can you give us some of those top line findings, those top line data points?
We do two things in the paper. One, we talk about the overall just potential if you compare endowments and think about the total amount under these energy transition projections. But a big thing we do is quantify the disparity. So we find that reservation areas are much less likely to see utility scale wind and solar development than comparable private lands. And we show that this disparity, if we were to scale it up using these projections, could be up to $19 billion of foregone earnings tribes would accrue had they had development similar to comparable private lands, right? So we're talking about billions of dollars.
Over $19 billion in lease and tax earnings through 2050. Is that right?
Yes. So one thing that we do make an assumption in the paper is thinking about what the compensation would look like. And we assume that this would be the same as it currently compensation works for private land. So if you have renewable energy development on private land, the community typically accrues some tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also payments to the landowners.
We're talking about a study of the economic potential of solar and wind power on Native American reservations with two of the study authors from UW-Madison. We have Sarah Johnston, an assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, and Nick Parker is with us, applied economics professor. Nick, The key question you're seeking to answer with the study is whether renewable energy could help reduce poverty on reservations. Indigenous people have the highest poverty rates of any minority group in the U.S. Can you talk about the economic realities and what this type of renewable energy could mean?
Absolutely. The poverty for Native Americans in general is extreme, but particularly for those who live on American Indian reservations. They have consistently been the most impoverished minority group in the United States. And reservations are in remote areas. They're far from urban labor markets. Some have benefited from casino development. Some have been very entrepreneurial. But many are at a disadvantage because of their location. So this struck us as important because, you know, here's a resource, wind and solar, that's expected to grow. And the time to kind of remove barriers for tribes wanting to develop is now, if we're going to have continued push towards renewable energy into the future. And so to quantify what this could be, I mean, this is not a panacea, and none of the authors of this study think this is a magic bullet for solving economic development challenges for Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. But it's potentially an important one. And one of the things we find in the paper is the 25% of American Indian reservations, so there's over 300 in the continental U.S., the 25% that are the poorest are also the 25% with the most wind and solar economic potential. And those are reservations that are remote. They don't have access to opportunities to hold casinos, for example. And so when you think about this potential to earn $19 billion, what does that mean on a per capita basis? Well, if you divide that by the population of American Indians that are living in the poorest 25% of reservations, that number is about 50,000 per person. And that's in, you know, 50,000 per person for a future stream of benefits from wind and solar. Well, you know, to put that in perspective, the per capita income from all other sources for these lower income populations is, you know, 12,000 or so. So this is significant.
It's very significant. And Sarah, if tribal communities would decide that they would like to pursue renewables, we mentioned earlier there are barriers. And I wonder, who would tribes need to interface with or build business relationships with off tribal lands to make renewable energy projects a reality?
So I think that oftentimes tribes who are pursuing utility scale renewable development will partner with wind or solar energy development companies. And you see more too, tribes are also doing their own development, although often partnering with one of these developers who's developed a lot of projects. But beyond that, there's a lot of regulatory hurdles to build this renewable energy infrastructure everywhere, but they're more difficult to navigate often on these reservation areas because regulatory authorities has this complicated mixture of there's federal, tribal, and state agencies involved. And there's often just, especially given the federal government, a lot of regulatory steps to go through before building one of these projects.
Nick, do you see any tribal communities moving forward with renewables in the future?
We do. I mean, there's examples of tribes that have started the process, and there's examples of tribes that have completed the process. So there's a big solar energy development on the Navajo Nation. Many tribes are expressing interests. I will say we highlight many of the regulatory barriers in the paper. We talk about the red tape that stands in the way of tribes that do want to develop. It was there for oil and gas and fossil fuel projects. It's still there for renewable energy projects. But the federal government is aware of this. Tribes are aware of this. And it seems there is some movement towards easing some of these obstacles. One thing that we note in the paper is, well, a simple way to streamline the process is to give tribes the authority to make energy development plans
without requiring Bureau of Indian Affairs approval for each leasing decision. That is true energy sovereignty, is to make your own decisions without all the regulatory hurdles.
And I noticed at the end of your report a bunch of caveats as well, as you talk about all of those different types of, as you mentioned, red tape in order to get to these renewable energy projects. So where does this research go from here?
There is a lot to learn here from detailed case studies. I hope there's a lot of follow-up research digging into specific examples of the experiences of tribes. We're also interested in critical minerals. So there's a push in the U.S. for domestic production of critical minerals that will be necessary for storage batteries in an energy transition, for example. So if the federal government is committed to producing those domestically, not buying them from China, for example, where are you going to look for domestic production of critical minerals? Well, one natural place is American Indian reservations, tribal nations.
Sarah and Dominic, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing this research.
Thanks for having us. Pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Sarah Johnston is an assistant professor of agricultural and applied economics, and Dominic Parker is a professor of applied economics, both at UW-Madison. They talked with my co-host Kate Archer-Kent about a study they co-authored in the journal Nature. It's called Economic Potential of Wind and Solar in American Indian Communities. Coming up, a Wisconsin historian shares the story of women pirates and the role of pirates in history.
Pirates start off as poor sailors who mutiny. It's one way of seeing them is just as criminals, but another way of seeing them is a class revolt.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The 17th century was the golden age for pirates. That included some fearsome women, sometimes in disguise as men, on the high seas. The Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc launched a series of presentations spotlighting historical seafaring women. The series is called The Great Women of the Great Lakes and Beyond. This month is about female pirates. Michelle Kuhl is a professor of history at UW Oshkosh. She's set to give a presentation about female pirates and talk to Kate Archer-Kent about her research.
Your history classes range from African-American history, and they touch down on women's history, to the history of pirates. What is the connection you find between the history of pirates and your other areas of research?
Well, that's a great question. This is all under the umbrella of social history. Before the mid-20th century, most history was about people with power from the top down, presidents, generals, right? You know, but with the civil rights movement, the second wave feminist movement, the Black Power movement, a number of other movements, people started wanting to hear about the history of people who maybe didn't have as much power and maybe weren't literate and didn't leave a lot of letters and diaries or documents or things like that. So I got really interested in women's history, and that also, I was also very interested in race. I grew up in North Carolina in the 70s and 80s when they were still getting around to integrating schools. And when I went to graduate school, I took a lot of social history from professors who look at history, as we say, from the bottom up instead of from the top down. We look at it from the bottom up. So pirates are part of that because pirates start off as poor sailors who mutiny. It's one way of seeing them is just as criminals, but another way of seeing them is a class revolt of poor sailors revolting against poor treatment and poor pay and hoping for a better life for themselves. So all three of these things come out of sort of mid to late 20th century movements to learn more about the world and look at all people in history.
And 1650s through the late 1720s is described as this golden age for pirates. And this is a period associated with colonization and the African slave trade and trade routes. Do you think that female piracy is like a natural extension there of your research into these underrepresented voices?
Absolutely, right? And female pirates are very unusual. There's not too many of them. So the few that there are, people are very fascinated with them because it's a very male world, the world of sailors, the world of the Navy, the world of merchant ships. For a lot of reasons that men were the ones who had these jobs. It required a lot of brute strength to be a sailor, to load cargo on and off ships and to hoist sails and to do all these things or to, you know, load cannon and fight. So it's a very male dominated world. So people get really fascinated with the women in it. So there's only a few women who are pirates, but they take an outside importance in the imagination.
And I thought historically women weren't allowed to be on these ships, especially once they set sail. Were women allowed on board?
That's a great question. For the most part, no. Many ship captains, both legitimate ship captains and pirate ship captains, didn't want women on board because they found it divisive that basically the crew would fight over them and it would cause tensions amongst the men and cut into their camaraderie and whatnot, which was very important to them for their fighting strength and their ability to work together and basically not die at sea, right? Mm. Because it's very risky to cross the Atlantic or the Pacific in these little wooden boats. Unfortunately, this is a world of a lot of violence, a lot of dominance, a lot of authority, and many of the men certainly liked visiting women, prostitutes. Some of them had wives when they were on shore, but they did not want women on the ship because it sort of broke up the male bonding, as it were, on the ship.
And it seems like this lasted for quite some time in history in seafaring professions, barring women, until like fairly recent history, like in the 20th century. What have you found there?
Well, right. There's actually some people who push back against that a bit and argue that there's actually more women than we realize on ships, that they come as seamstresses and laundresses and things like that. So it is a contested situation about like basically, you know, what they're saying in public and what they're doing in private. This is also true of wars as well, that we think of, you know, 18th, 19th century wars as being almost entirely all male, but there's often quite a few women. They are sometimes called camp followers or things like that, who traveled with armies to do laundry and make food and boil water or, you know, boil the lice out of your clothing, things like that. That would be very helpful. And there's more of that than you might think. And they're sometimes even considered so important that they're given rations and things like that. In the Seven Years' War before the American Revolution, the Puritans of New England were actually pretty horrified about fighting alongside British regiments against the French because there were so many of these camp followers that the Puritans basically considered, you know, prostitutes. Hmm. And that was a real source of tension between the New England Puritans and the British Army. I think one of the historians that talks about this is Linda Grant DePaul, who argues that there's actually more women at sea than we thought. And another author is Diane Dugow, who thinks there's more of them than we might know. But it's an ongoing conversation amongst historians.
Is there any indication that female pirates were captains of their own ships?
One of the most successful pirates ever was a Chinese woman who amassed a huge fleet. And basically the government couldn't defeat her, so they basically bribed her. So she's one of the most powerful in terms of just sheer number of people who sailed under her. There's an Irish woman who's a captain as well. But again, they're pretty unusual. In the Caribbean, there's two famous women pirates, Anne Bonny and Mary Read, and they don't become captains. They mainly just sail around with the pirates for a little bit.
I was fascinated by their story. Mary Read, an English pirate, and a crewmate, this Anne Bonny. And so what were they able to accomplish together?
Well, I think what a lot of pirates accomplished, which was to basically reject the life you're born with and create a new life. And it's a trade-off, right? And this is true for poor sailors. It's true for these women who are turning their backs on their nation. Often they're turning their backs on religion. They're turning their backs on their identities. And in the case of women, they're turning their backs on the expectations of women at the time. They're turning their backs on being ladies, right? There's mm-hmm. no lady pirates, right? And so by being a pirate, they are embracing a risky, probably short life, but one that has more freedom, more wealth, and more adventure than their old life. It's one of the reasons the pirate flag across multiple pirate ships has some form of death on it. The death's head, a skeleton, sometimes a skeleton holding an hourglass. Mm-hmm. And those symbols are partly about trying to frighten other ships, right? That we're coming. And pirates are brave, but they're also kind of lazy. So if they could frighten ships into just like surrendering and giving over their treasure, great, right? So they do a lot of things that try to frighten other ships. But they also use that symbol as part of their ethos of saying, we would rather die in a battle at sea in a year or two than live a horrible life, toiling away for little money, for little autonomy, with little control over your life. We're tossing aside that life and we're trading it for a short, violent, but exciting life that we control. And I think for these women pirates, they're definitely embracing that side of piracy.
We're talking about the history of female pirates with Michelle Kuhl, professor at UW-Oshkosh, and giving a presentation at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. It's called Great Women of the Great Lakes and Beyond. Is there any indication, Michelle, you know, here in the Great Lakes, we found many shipwrecks. Do you know of any treasures that they acquired?
Yeah, this history in this area is really rich. Anywhere you have a coastline and something of a weak state, pirates pop up. So that's mm-hmm. true in the ancient world, in the Mediterranean. That's true off the coast of Somalia right now. It's true in parts of the Amazon River. Anytime you have water and people on boats and there's a weakness, people will pop up and take advantage of that weakness and try to steal things from other people. So, right. So the Great Lakes are true, too. If there's parts of the coastline that are not well patrolled, pirates will fill that gap.
Do you know anything about the bounties that these female pirates were able to acquire? Any historical records there?
Oh, that's a great question. I would imagine that the Chinese pirate got a great deal more treasure than any other pirate in history. The female pirates, too, I have a theory of the ones in the Caribbean. They're both associated with a man named Calico Jack Rackham, who wore colorful calico prints, probably from India or somewhere else, going around and trading. And he was kind of a ladies' man. They both kind of had a relationship with him, and he dressed sort of flamboyantly. And I've always thought he is maybe the inspiration for the character in the Pirates of the Caribbean,
the
main character. And I think they don't have, and so I think the female pirates have that association help popularize him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When you talk about Anne Bonny, a legendary female pirate, they were also known to dress in men's clothing as a disguise. Can you tell us about that impact of dressing as male pirates?
Right. Apparently, they were pretty good at that. And mm-hmm. I believe it's Mary Read, whose mother started her down that road, because mm-hmm. her mother had a husband who went to sea and they had a son. But then the son died and the wife got pregnant by another man. And she gave birth to a girl, but she didn't want her husband or her husband's family to know that she'd had this illegitimate child by another man. So she dressed her as a boy. And apparently it worked. Her husband's family kept supporting her financially and whatnot. So she grew up having that cross-dressing experience. So she was pretty good at imitating not just how men dressed, but how they walked, right? How they interacted with people and things like that. So when she became a pirate, she ran into another woman who was also dressing as a pirate. And apparently they're both pretty brave. They fought well. And it's only when their breasts were exposed that they could be known as women, and that sort of gave them away.
These stories of disguise, I think, as you mentioned earlier, are applicable to other areas of battle for women, whether it's in a war or on a pirate ship.
Absolutely. Right. There's some indication that on a day-to-day basis on the pirate ship, since everyone knew who they were, you know, by that point, they probably wore women's clothing, but they put men's clothing on for battle. Like if they were heading towards another ship and there was going to be a fight, they would put on trousers and bind up their chests and so that they could sword fight and things like that. And apparently, by all accounts, they were very brave and they beat some men pretty badly.
The drink being offered during your presentation is called grog. How is grog associated with pirates?
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that. That's fantastic. Well, the way people thought about alcohol in these earlier centuries is very different than the way we think about it today. We know a lot about the chemistry of alcohol and how it affects your brain and your liver and all these sorts of things. But in earlier times, particularly in England, a lot of their rivers were polluted. The Thames in London was just disgusting, right? There's horses urinating and defecating in the street. People are tossing offal and, you know, chicken guts and pig guts, and they're just, you know, dead bodies. So it's just the water, they didn't understand the chemistry of it. Like they hadn't yet looked at things through microscopes and discovered the world of microscopic germs and viruses and bacteria. But they knew that drinking the water could make you sick, whereas drinking something like beer or cider didn't make you sick. And we know today it's the fermentation process kills the bacteria. They didn't know that. So people, children, teenagers, adults, all drink quite a lot of beer. Benjamin Franklin went to London to work at a printer shop at one point in the 18th century, and he liked experimenting with his food and drink. He was a vegetarian for a time, experimentally, and he decided to stop drinking, and he noticed that the people around him routinely drank 6 pints a day, like a pint at breakfast, a pint at your mid-morning, a pint at lunch, a pint after lunch, a pint in the afternoon, and a pint with dinner. And he noticed that when he quit drinking and he just drank water, he was clear-headed and could carry more than the other men, which to our eyes today we think, well, of course, you're not drunk all day. But it's very routine. And rum was an important part, and other alcoholic drinks, of naval ships and the merchant naval ships. And it sometimes would help the sailors have a perception of warmth. We all know that's not real, but a perception of warmth in cold climates and things like that, and sort of pacified them, and they expected it. So it was almost part of their like rations or wages. If you've ever seen guys at a football game with their shirts off in freezing weather, like at a Packers game, you know, they're drunk, so they don't feel the cold. It's really not a great practice for those listening. But that's sort of what sailors did. If they were sailing around like pretty far south, like around the tip of South America or something, it's very cold and they didn't have great clothing, and they would drink a lot to try and feel warm. So people were drunk quite a bit in those days.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your research.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Michelle Kuhl is a professor of history at UW Oshkosh. She talked to Kate Archer Kent. Her presentation is set for tonight at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. It's part of its series called Great Women of the Great Lakes and Beyond. And for disclosure, Wisconsin Maritime Museum is a business sponsor of WPR. Coming up next week on the show, we're going to check out the state of childcare in Wisconsin when it comes to availability and affordability, and we'll meet a Manitowoc business owner who tried to find some childcare solutions for his employees. We want to hear from you. Are you or someone in your family trying to solve a childcare puzzle right now? Are there options in your area? Are they affordable? Are friends or family helping out? Have you left the workforce or gone to part-time because that ended up being cheaper than paying for childcare? Tell us about it. Call at 888-642-0232. You can text or leave a message there. That's 888-642-0232. Or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, and we can share your story. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.